Today is Tuesday, October 26th, and you are listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. I am Junaid Rafa, broadcasting from Washington, D.C. Coming up, protests continue in Sudan as UN discusses military takeover.
He called again for the release of the prime minister. He urged the military and all other stakeholders to exercise maximum restraint.
Plus, UN warns Amazon rainforest is emitting carbon dioxide.
The Amazonian rainforest ecosystem, which used to be a major sink of carbon, has become now a source of carbon.
Also, deep divisions among EU countries as gas prices surge. Our top story today is in Sudan. The tense situation in Sudan will be discussed at the UN Security Council on Tuesday as global condemnation continues after the military ousted the transitional government. Pro-democracy protesters have blocked roads in Sudan's capital with makeshift barricades and burning tires. Soldiers and the feared rapid support forces patrolled Khartoum neighborhoods overnight, chasing protesters. The international group Human Rights Watch said forces used live ammunition against demonstrators. The United States, the United Kingdom, and Norway jointly called on security forces to release those who were detained unlawfully and requested the coup leaders to, quote, stand down, unquote. The U.S. State Department has paused $700 million in economic aid to Sudan. For more, I spoke with VOA UN correspondent Margaret Bashir.
It's a huge setback for the United Nations. They've been working with the military civilian government there now since 2019. The people have great aspirations to have democracy, to move forward, and this is a huge setback to all of it. I asked the Secretary General about it this morning, and he called again for the release of the Prime Minister. He urged the military and all other stakeholders to exercise maximum restraint, and he strongly condemned the military's takeover. You know, he wants to see this reversed.
How likely is there to be a reversal based on the wish of the Secretary General? And what can UN do beyond just mere words?
The Secretary General's representative in Sudan, Volker Perthes, said yesterday that the leaders there do listen to the condemnations of the international community. You know, there is certain leverage that they have over them. The United States just cut $700 million in military aid. Sudan receives a lot of humanitarian and development assistance as well. I think countries are less likely to cut humanitarian assistance, but puts in jeopardy a lot of things. So the military needs to be careful in how they proceed with this. So there is leverage from the international community that they can use.
It appears the UN and the Secretary General specifically is concerned about what you call a trend, especially in Africa. How worried are they that this might lead to a descent into coups and counter-coups on the continent?
Well, I don't think anybody's projecting more coups, but the point is, as long as there's impunity, as long as there's no unity within the Security Council, you don't have a deterrent for some of these military leaders with aspirations. So it's concerning.
That's VOA UN correspondent Margaret Bashir speaking with me from New York. The military takeover in Sudan on Monday brings the number of such actions in Africa this year to four, following earlier military overthrows in Chad, Guinea, and Mali. Some analysts are suggesting that military takeovers are back in vogue in Africa after a consistent decrease in coups since the 2000s. Reporter Darren Taylor has the details.
According to the Stockholm International Peace Research Institute, there have been 94 successful military coups in Africa since 1951. Sudan would be the 95th. One of the institute's directors, Dr. Isaka Suere, says most of the coups happened in the 1960s and 1970s.
The data shows that coups, while we may be scandalous about their occurrence, compared to these heyday years, are on the waning side and trend, not on the up.
Nevertheless, says Suare, it's concerning that the beginning of the 2020s has so far seen four coups, given that there were only eight successful military coups between 2000 and 2010, and a mere five from 2010 until 2020. Suare partly credits the Lomé Declaration of 2000, the first continental instrument against coups, with decreasing their prevalence in Africa. The declaration, passed by the Organization of African Unity, the predecessor of the African Union, insisted on the condemnation of military takeovers. Suare says the 2012 African Charter on Democracy, Elections and Governance further reduced the appeal of coups by refusing to recognize governments born out of unconstitutional changes.
Some would argue that with these batteries of instruments, we should not actually be seeing military coups anymore on the continent, but they still do. Why? Are we likely to be seeing more coups, or are we likely to see a stagnation of the coup? Either way is possible.
He says several factors could determine this, including African consistency in condemning unconstitutional changes of government.
It's one thing to have instruments, it's another to apply them consistently. Because if you don't do it consistently, then loopholes would be created or widened, and therefore the balance may be tilted on the upper hand, the military combat.
Suare says governance methods in African nations will also decide whether coups will increase on the continent.
Conditions are sometimes, I say sometimes, exploited by military officers to justify their coming to the political sphere.
He says only consistently good governance, even when that's hard to achieve in poorer nations, can end the spectre of coups that's haunted Africa for decades. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
China is protesting a visit by Taiwanese government ministers to Czech capital, accompanied by business and research representatives to boost trade and investment. Beijing has threatened unspecified retaliatory steps. Taiwan relies on such exchange to counter China's effort to isolate the self-governing island, which Beijing claims as its own territory. The visit comes as tensions are rising between Taipei and Beijing, which has long said it eventually will take control of the island by force if necessary. Flora Bradley Watson of Reuters looks at how life has changed for a former soldier at a rocky outcrop some 3 kilometers from China's coast on Taiwan-controlled Kinmen Island.
On the windswept Taiwanese island of Kinmen, 50-year-old Cheng Ing-wang is remembering his time as a soldier shooting flares at Chinese trawlers that got too close. He's one of a group of veterans who returned to the island this month. Kinmen sits on the front line between China and Taiwan, just a short ferry ride from the mainland and an hour's flight from Taipei. It's the last place where the two engaged in major fighting in 1958, at the height of the Cold War. Decades later, Chen did his military service on Kinmen from 1991 to 1993 and remembers his encounters with the Chinese ships.
At night, you could hear the sound of the machines turning louder and louder. Then our cannons down there in the plains that we just passed would start to fire off flares. Once the flares lit up, we would see, oh my God, a bunch of ships have already approached.
Kinmen, along with the Matsu Islands, has been held by the government in Taipei since the defeated Republic of China forces fled to Taiwan in 1949. Regular shelling of Kinmen did not end until 1978, when Washington formally recognized Beijing over Taipei. China claims Taiwan as its own territory and has never ruled out the use of force to achieve unification. Earlier this month, China's Air Force carried out 4 days of mass incursions into Taiwan's air defense zone. The recent spike in tensions has sparked alarm in Western capitals in Taipei. It's also got the locals of Kinmen worried. Jessica Chen runs a local tea shop.
Of course, everyone is afraid of war, but I hope there can be peace in the Taiwan Strait. I hope that we can join hands and get along. If there are any problems, we can sit down and talk it out. We should not ignite the fuse of war. If we can pave the road for this, then coming generations will have no worries in their lives.
Kinmen's government is working hard to promote the island as more than just a war monument. But the remnants of conflict are everywhere, from bunkers on the beach to anti-landing fortifications along the shore and tanks rumbling through the back streets.
That's Flora Bradley Watson of Reuters. Divisions deepen among European Union countries ahead of an emergency meeting of ministers on Tuesday on the bloc's response to a spike in energy prices. Some countries seek a regulatory overhaul, while others firmly oppose. European gas prices have hit record high this autumn, prompting most EU countries to respond with emergency measures like price caps and subsidies to help trim consumer energy bills. Countries are struggling to agree on a long-term plan to cushion against fuel price swings, which Spain, France, the Czech Republic, Greece say warrant a shake-up of the way EU energy markets work. Those countries will make a case on Tuesday for proposals that include decoupling European electricity and gas prices, jointly buying gas, and, in the case of a few countries, delayed planned climate change policies. EU Energy Commissioner Kadri Simpson.
I do hope to hear clear messages from ministers. What are their expectations? If we're talking about medium-term measures, this also means that we have to start acting right now, despite the fact that results of those actions will be foreseen in years to come, not in next weeks.
That's EU Energy Commissioner Kadri Simpson. In the United States, President Joe Biden's administration is offering details of a new COVID-19 vaccination requirements for most foreign travelers flying into the country. AP correspondent Sagar Magani reports.
The Biden administration is offering details on new COVID-19 vaccination requirements for most foreign travelers flying to the U.S. Starting November 8th, they'll have to be fully vaccinated.
And to provide proof of vaccination status prior to boarding an airplane to the United States.
State Department spokesman Ned Price says there will be very limited exceptions.
Primarily, children under the age of 18 and certain individuals from countries where vaccines are not yet readily accessible.
All travelers will need to be tested before boarding a plane to the U.S. The administration says it's working with airlines who will have to enforce the procedures and collect contact tracing information. The CDC will spot check passengers for compliance. Sagar Magani, Washington.
Chronic fatigue, brain fog, insomnia, heart problems and difficulties breathing. Those are just some of the symptoms of long COVID. Lecia Bacalets looked into what long COVID really is and how U.S. doctors are treating the condition. Anna Rice narrates her story.
Even after recovering from COVID-19, many people report lingering effects for months later. According to a report by Fair Health, a nonprofit organization focused on transparency in healthcare, about 15 to 20% of those who have contracted the virus continue to have symptoms months later. 14-year-old Sienna from Cleveland got COVID about a year ago.
My smells came back, but they came back all like completely different, like distorted and everything. So like regular foods tasted like I always describe it as burning rubber, like this really weird smell.
Doctors call such a long rehabilitation process long COVID. The World Health Organization calls the lingering symptoms post-COVID.
It occurs in individuals with a history of probable or confirmed SARS-CoV-2 infection, usually 3 months from the onset of the COVID-19, with symptoms that last for at least 2 months and cannot be explained by an alternative diagnosis.
The U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention lists 18 common symptoms, including cough, headaches, shortness of breath, insomnia, heart palpitations, and oftentimes chronic fatigue.
Fatigue is a really common symptom. It's a really dominant one. And the fatigue often is coupled with what patients describe as, quote, brain fog, which would be difficulty concentrating, cognitive issues, cloudiness.
Dr. Linda Jiang works with post-COVID patients at a Stanford University clinic. One challenge is making sure these common symptoms are post-COVID and not something else.
And there's a clear time correlation of persistence of symptoms that they didn't have before COVID, and there weren't other coinciding events that occurred or health changes, then it sort of eliminates the other possibilities.
The number of long COVID centers has mushroomed across the U.S. Social media support groups are also helping patients deal with the mental impact of post-COVID symptoms. Experts say mood swings, anxiety, and depression are very common. Former nurse Lainey Bond says her support group gains an additional 1,500 people a week.
We're really focused on what we would call a nursing patient education.
The U.S. National Institutes of Health have launched a $470 million project aimed at learning more about post-COVID symptoms and finding a treatment. For Lesa Bakalets in Washington, Anna Rice, VOA News.
At least 20 asylum seekers have tested positive for COVID-19 while being detained at a hotel in Australia. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
About 46 male asylum seekers have been detained at the Park Hotel in Melbourne. Almost half have tested positive for COVID-19. Some are reportedly immunocompromised, including one detainee who has burns to more than half of his body after he set himself on fire at an offshore processing facility. The detainees were flown in from Australian offshore migrant camps in Papua New Guinea and Nauru during the past 2 years, mostly for medical treatment. The Australian Border Force, which operates the hotel detention facility, says those who are unwell have been closely monitored and given proper medical care. A media release states that multiple nursing staff are on site and a general practitioner has attended the site and is available via telehealth at all times. It adds that all detainees in Australian immigration detention facilities have been offered COVID-19 vaccinations. However, refugee advocates tell a different story. They insist the hotel has become an incubator for the virus and that nursing staff work only during the day. Ian Rintoul, a spokesperson for the Refugee Action Coalition, a community campaign organisation, describes conditions inside the hotel as a national scandal.
There is one who's been hospitalised quite seriously. People have serious symptoms, chest pain. Some people are quite unwell, others are, mild symptoms. But the idea that they're being monitored regularly is just nonsense. They've got no access to fresh air, no access to exercise. It is not a proper facility to be quarantining or isolating people.
Almost every asylum seeker in the Melbourne hotel has been detained by Australia for more than 8 years. A 2013 policy barred any migrant trying to reach Australia by sea from resettlement. Papua New Guinea was one of two Pacific countries paid by Canberra, along with the small Pacific Republic of Nauru, to detain asylum seekers and refugees. The agreement with Papua New Guinea, or PNG, is scheduled to finish at the end of the year. Migrants there will either be transferred to Nauru or be allowed to resettle in PNG. Australia grants resettlement visas to about 13,700 refugees each year under various humanitarian schemes. Australia has detected 160,000 coronavirus cases since the pandemic began. More than 1,600 people have died. 74% of the eligible population is fully vaccinated, and long lockdowns in Sydney, Canberra and Melbourne were recently lifted. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney, Australia.
You are listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. I am Chinedu Ofor, broadcasting from Washington, D.C. The World Meteorological Organization warns the battle to stem climate change may be lost as new information indicates the Amazon rainforest is turning from a carbon sink or area that absorbs carbon dioxide into a source of carbon dioxide. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
The latest edition of the WMO's Greenhouse Gas Bulletin reports emissions of carbon dioxide, methane, and nitrous oxide once again broke all records last year. It warns the concentrations of these greenhouse gas emissions into the atmosphere are driving climate change. It says carbon dioxide, the single most important greenhouse gas, accounts for approximately 66% of the warming effect on the climate. The Secretary General of the World Meteorological Organization, Pieteri Talas, says about half of CO2 emissions remains in the atmosphere for centuries. He says the other half is taken up by oceans and land ecosystems. He says it is not clear for how much longer forested areas, often referred to as the lungs of the earth, will continue to act as effective carbon sinks.
We have already seen some alarming indications that, for example, the Amazonian rainforest ecosystem, which used to be a major sink of carbon, has become now a source of carbon, which is alarming. And this is related to deforestation in the area and also changes in local climate because of this deforestation.
Oksana Tarasova heads the WMO's Atmospheric and Environmental Research Division. She says the WMO only now is revealing this new finding because it has taken 9 years of observation to gather the measurement data set needed to understand the changes taking place. She says not all the Amazon forest is turning from a carbon sink to a net producer of carbon.
So the western part of the Amazonia still continues to work as a carbon sink at this point. But we don't know for how long that will continue this way. We are making the measurements there and keeping track on what is happening there. If we take the whole Amazonia as the whole basin, then it is a sink, but its capacity is substantially reduced.
Meteorologists say climate change negotiators at an upcoming conference in Scotland must take concrete action and make concrete pledges to reduce carbon dioxide emissions. They say setting carbon neutral targets will not work in stemming climate change. They also warn the world is heading toward a temperature rise of 2.5 degrees Celsius by the end of this century. This, they say, is far more than the Paris Agreement target of 1.5 to 2 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Madagascar is known for its rich and diverse wildlife, but experts say forest degradation is a growing threat to both animals and humans. As Anu Zonku reports, from Madagascar's Sitongambarika forest, there are success stories thanks to reforestation efforts meant to alter the effects of climate change.
Last year, this waterfall in the Sitongambarika forest disappeared for 6 months as many waterways in the forest dried up. The state, with the help of the local population, launched a reforestation program.
We use this water source for our farms, and I'm proud to contribute to the reforestation of this forest, which is a source of life. Our children will not have the same environmental problems as we do.
The south of Madagascar is suffering a 4-year drought that the World Food Program says is the worst in 40 years. The country has also lost nearly 40% of its natural forest. Advocates blame climate change, but also the cutting of trees by the local populations. The Sitongambarika forest is a model of reforestation in the country. It has been reconstituted to more than 60%. 39,000 hectares have been restored out of a total area of 59,000 hectares. It is an important conservation area, protecting many endemic and threatened species.
It contributes especially to the mitigation of climate change at the global level. The forest of Tungabarika is a carbon sink at the global level in a context where greenhouse gas emissions are increasingly important. Madagascar contributes to this global objective.
According to data drawn from the Global Carbon Project, Madagascar produces less than 0.01% of all the carbon dioxide generated in the world. Researchers say about 50% of the world's animal and plant species live on the island. Madagascar's president calls for everyone to do their part.
What we are asking is that the countries that pollute the most should help the countries that pollute the least, so that we can really, in my opinion, mitigate the impact of this climate change and help the population in this part of the island.
During the upcoming UN Climate Change Conference, the states are expected to find an agreement to limit global warming to avert any more crises like the drought that threatened Madagascar's forest land. Anne Zwanke for VOA News, Sitongambarika, Madagascar.
That's it for our show today. For more in-depth and breaking news 24 hours a day, please visit voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Nadia Taha, and our managing editor, Kate Pound-Dawson, I am Chinedu Okwa in Washington. Thank you so much for listening. And have a pleasant evening.